Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Martine Paris, Director of Business Development at Strategic Content Partnerships and the producer of tonight's program, Rockstar Revolution, a discussion with Pandora, iMeme, Spin, and CreateSpace on the revolution in indie music, production, and distribution, for it has never been easier to create your masterpiece and sell it to your fans. Many thanks go to Shepard Mullin's Digital Media Law Forum for generously sponsoring this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to you our panel moderator for this evening, Riaz Karamali, a partner of Shepard Mullin Richter & Hampton, who, with over 20 years' experience, enjoys a law practice in the areas of company formation, venture capital financing, mergers and acquisitions, and licensing and technology transactions for digital media companies. Please join me in welcoming Riaz Karamali.
Thank you, Martine, and thank you, everybody, for coming out here on this wet evening. And it's my honor to introduce the panel, and I'm going to go down the row here, starting with immediately to my left, Tim Westergren. Tim Westergren founded Pandora in January 2000 and now serves as its chief strategy officer. An award-winning composer, accomplished musician, and record producer with 20 years in the music industry, Tim has scored feature films, managed artists, produced albums, and performed extensively. He is obsessed with helping emerging artists connect with the music fans most likely to appreciate their music, and with Pandora is a leader in the indie music revolution. And next to Tim, Steve Jang. Steve serves as the chief marketing officer and head of business development at iMeme. In his role, Steve oversees iMeme's brand building and marketing activities and guides iMeme's relationships with its strategic music, video, and technology partners. And together with founder and CEO Dalton Caldwell, Steve also guides product management for iMeme's web-based social networking site. Prior to joining iMeme, Steve worked at EMI Music, Zuma, W.R. Hambrecht, and Salon.com. And next to Steve is Dana Lopiccolo-Giles, who is co-founder and managing director of CreateSpace, formerly Custom Flix, which was acquired by Amazon in 2005. Dana, along with brother Darren Giles, founded Custom Flix in 2002 to profitably connect content owners to a worldwide audience through on-demand media production, offering books, CDs, DVDs, and downloads on demand through CreateSpace. Dana strives to give authors, filmmakers, and musicians a way to monetize their works on Amazon as well as other online venues. And at the end is Nyan McAvoy. Nyan is chief executive officer of Spin Magazine and the chairman and CEO of Chronicle Books. He began his career in the business affairs departments of the William Morris Agency in Beverly Hills and with Westcom Productions. He serves as commissioner for the Smithsonian American Art Museum on the boards of the UCSC Foundation and the Photography Accession Subcommittee of SF MoMA, and as drummer for the elusive rock band Rough Draft. So I'd like to hear about that. So as you can see, we have just an amazing panel here and a very interesting topic. And I think we'll start with each of the panelists just telling us a little bit about their company, about the company's role in the digital music ecosystem, and the role it plays in indie music discovery and distribution. So Tim, would you lead off, please?
I like the elusive rock band description. I'm going to use that myself. So Pandora is a free personalized radio service delivered mostly over the web, but now to mobile phones and hopefully soon to cars. We have about 22 million registered listeners in the U.S., and we streamed about 1 billion hours of music last year. Pandora is based on something called the Music Genome Project, which is this enormous musical taxonomy that we've been building since the beginning of 2000. It's a hand-built musicological kind of collection of DNA. We've had about 30 musicians analyzing songs one at a time along close to 400 attributes per song to build this sort of connective tissue that allows us to put similar sounding songs together to make playlists and lets users personalize them in real time. 70% of the 70,000 artists in our collection are unsigned artists, so we play a lot of independent music. And on a spin-weighted basis, so just based on the number of songs spun, over half the songs you play are independent. We have no preference for signed or unsigned artists. It's a very democratic and inclusive collection. And we have stuff from major labels as well as, you know, homemade CDs that we get, freshly burned CD-ROMs with track titles written in Sharpie on the CD-ROMs. If it's good, it goes in the collection. It's really one of our missions as a company to really create sort of a level playing field and offer sort of for the first time ever access to working artists for to mass promotion. A good majority of these artists have never played on radio before, and we sort of view it as our job to help, you know, catalyze the creation of a new musician's middle class. So we're on a mission to do that.
Thanks, Tim. Mm-hmm. And we'll come back with questions, but we'll go on to Steve.
Sure. Hi, I'm Steve from iMeme, and iMeme is a relatively new social network really focused around music. And so it's a bunch of guys from local schools around here, Stanford, Berkeley, a lot of expats from other digital music services like Rhapsody and Napster, and a core engineering team that also came from the original Napster, Sean Panik's Napster. So we all got together and wanted to do something really cool on the web around social music. At the time, this is 2005, 2006, it was pretty much MySpace and Friendster, Flickr was getting popular. And we thought there was a huge opportunity in that music is, I think, in my opinion, the most exciting entertainment content, period. And so, and everyone identifies by it emotionally and can even trace their history and their personality and everything in their life around their music taste. And we thought there was a real interesting opportunity around creating a product that could tap into that. And so today we are a web-based social network. We have over 30 million registered users. We have over 115 million unique visitors to our site, our widgets, and our apps that exist out there in the various sites out there, like blogs, other social networks, artist websites. With regard to who can use it, we really built iMeme to be, in essence, a social mixtape or playlist community. Users can create playlists of whatever songs they choose, whatever they're into. You can make a grad school playlist. You can make a grad night playlist. You can make a playlist for your night out on Friday with your friends. You can make a playlist that's your workout playlist. And you can select all the songs that you like, videos too. You can put them together quickly, and you can share them with your friends, and you can embed them as widgets or apps in other social networks and blogs. So we've really tried to create a platform where people can create personalized playlists, but also for artists and labels, whether you're unsigned, signed, major label, indie label, you're able to yourself, do it yourself, self-service, upload your content, register the content with our back-end infrastructure. We use Snowcap. And then to be able to promote your music, to track how many times it's played, by whom, by where, and to be able to monetize that. And so we operate a download store that is called My Store. It's available on MySpace. We also allow you to create playlists that are streaming, and you can market and promote yourself as well. We've just ventured into mobile as well. And mobile is really exciting because now people can have their music experience, their personalized taste, go with them wherever they are. And so I think that's something that I think we're going to touch on, but I think it's really exciting now.
Thanks, Steve. So both iMeme and Pandora are very interesting music services, but the user experience is very different. The licensing models are very different. We'll come back and explore those a little bit in more detail. And we'll go on to Dana right now.
All right, thanks. So CreateSpace helps our members monetize their content. By producing discs and books on demand. We also help them distribute things digitally. But the on-demand concept is very important here. So what we're doing is storing their content on servers and literally printing books, binding them and shipping them out, or CDs or DVDs one at a time as customers are ordering. As Riaz said, we're a wholly owned subsidiary of Amazon, and a lot of the content that our members put in are available for sale through Amazon.com, other sales channels, e-stores, Amazon MP3 store, Amazon Video On Demand. So the service, it's free to set up titles. The only cost is a proof copy so that our members can make sure they're happy with the quality of the goods. We try to produce units that look identical to the same sort of physical goods you get on a store shelf. So, you know, full-color packaging, full-color discs, overwrap, the whole works. Our members set the list price of their titles, and they're paid based on the list price. And that's very important so that they really have control over what their content's being sold at. One of the really important things that we do, it's a non-exclusive deal. There are no minimums. The artists maintain all of their rights. So they're free to go seek distribution, get signed, and we certainly applaud when they do get deals. So this is, again, really trying to enable our members to reach the broadest possible audience. And Tim, when you were talking about your mission there, it struck a chord. When we started the company, literally started in my basement, one of our missions was to democratize distribution and really kind of create a level playing field. It's pretty exciting because our service is used by large companies. You know, we have Sony BMG and EMI taking stuff that's out of print, putting it through us and making it available through Amazon.com. All the way down to students in their dorm rooms, you know, releasing their titles and showing up, you know, with equal placement on Amazon and other sales channels. So it's pretty exciting to see that happening.
Great. Thanks, Dana. Nayan?
Hi. I'm here representing Spin Magazine, which is sort of the, you know, from a previous era. And we found that it had fallen on hard times and decided that there was an opportunity to try and restore it, at least to refocus it on contemporary music and to try and get a team of people there who really could understand that music and write about it well. So it's more of a curatorial model. We try to select artists that we think people should know about and present them in a way that makes them exciting both verbally and visually. We also saw an opportunity to take the brand into a digital era, and rather than simply step away from print, we feel that there is that there are advantages to having a foot in both worlds, and that having a sort of physical avatar for what we do, where the image will be seen on newsstands in airports and drugstores and wherever they sell magazines, if they still do these days, that it has an impact and it actually adds a luster to the subjects that you're covering. At the same time, to reach our audience, it's important to take that brand onto the web and to find continually fresh ways of doing that. We've done that through doing a partnership with MySpace in the delivery of digital versions of the magazine, and also in burnishing the website, in doing partnerships with Sonic Bids on finding young breakthrough artists, and with a new project called Spin Earth that we'll be introducing soon.
Thanks, Nayan. And so my first question will be to you, Nayan. And I'd just like to ask you about, obviously, Spin as a magazine made a name for bringing up cutting-edge artists to public light. And 20 years ago, you know, maybe it was the only media outlet really doing that in a big way. And that's still a big part of your mission. Is it a lot easier now with the Internet to find indie artists and to find the next great artists and with the environment that we're in today?
It is much easier to find them, and certainly the gentlemen to my right have all done important things in making the work of indie artists more available. And there are lots of venues where you can, it's easier to build heat through crowdsourced interest. In other words, user-generated interest. But I think there's still room for what I was calling curation, which is to say for people who, you know, listen to more of the stuff than any of us could possibly listen to and just and make a point of trying to fight their way through it and write about it and communicate with other people about it. So I still think there's room for both the photographers who can make an artist really look exciting and the writers who can fill out what the story that isn't told by the imagery, and that is still an important part of breaking a band and making them exciting.
Thanks. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about music licensing and the business models of Pandora and iMeme, because both of you are you know, music services, and I'd like you to talk a little bit, Tim, about your model, about the licensing model and the revenue model.
Sure. So we're advertising supported, and we pay for Pandora by displaying paid advertising around the tuner, which is so largely graphic. There is some audio, and that will certainly be part of the puzzle going forward. As far as licensing goes, we operate under a piece of federal legislation called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which very conveniently provides kind of a one-stop shop for rights. It allows us, by signing one piece of paper, to play everything that we want to without asking permission. In fact, if an artist didn't want us to play them, we could still play it. So it has a great benefit because it allows us to play this incredible diversity of music, about 70,000 artists, whom if we had to find for direct deals would be impossible. We've had some complications with that license in the last couple years because it mandates that we pay a performance fee, so a royalty for every song that we stream, which is arbitrated in Washington every 5 years. And about a year and a half ago, the royalty panel that coughed up an answer on this kind of went off the rails and wound up with a number that was really unaffordable for us in the entire web radio industry. But thanks to an enormous amount of public pressure, that's getting resolved and hopefully quite soon. So I think that the whole statutory or compulsory licensing system is vital to the industry that we operate under because it allows for participation. You know, absent a kind of one central license system, independent artists would largely get shut out because no business would really be able to afford to directly license from them. So we are a radio, we're a webcaster. We don't actually play in the world of direct deals.
Okay. So you're not, though, writing checks to the independent artists. So as an independent artist, how do I make money off of having you play my songs?
Sure. So we do write large checks every month of this paying for this performance fee to a company called Sound Exchange, which collects these fees and then distributes them to artists and labels. Artists need to be members of Sound Exchange. They have to sign up for it. We also pay a publishing fee to ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC that's paid to the composer, so the sort of two revenue streams that wind up in artists' hands. We pay many, many millions of dollars a year in licensing fees.
Okay. So, Steve, tell us about your approach.
Sure. When we started building our product and the service, we were trying to really – the problem we were trying to solve was how do you create a playlist of music that you already own and that you're able to stream back to yourself, but create a playlist of it online so that you can have that experience rather than just use iTunes software clients or things like that. And then to be able to share that by simple, you know, web URLs, send a link to someone, say, hey, check out the playlist I created. How do you just solve that very simple problem? To do that, we looked, you know, far and wide and said, are there existing digital music licenses that permit this? And we couldn't find it. So we had to work directly with labels. So rather than there being an entity or a government body that would administer those rights on a preset or statutory basis, we actually had to go out and, pioneer a new licensing model directly with the labels and publishers, which was tough. It took us 2.5 years to do. We're still working on it. So it was a really difficult process, but what we tried to do is create an on-demand license for streaming that didn't have a lot of the rules that the DMCA compliant Sound Exchange interactive radio license represents. So we tried to create something that was truly on demand. It was free. It was ad supported. Our business is to serve ads against the attention that's paid by users on this great music content and this expression activity that's happening. So we had to work directly with many parties, and that's still happening today. It will happen a year from now, and it'll happen 5 years from now. The music industry is far too complex and global now for this to be something easy to solve. I've learned that over the last few years. So the important thing here is that this extends also to video. So if you think about YouTube and video and what's happening there, this is a very parallel and similar situation that's happening in audio. This concept of free on-demand streaming, whether it's a playlist or it's a single song player or a single video player, all of these things are philosophically tied. So we operate off of direct deals with all the labels, four majors, the long tail of indie labels and distributors. We're also looking at international opportunities, so we've been talking to European labels, Asian distribution houses. We work on a publishing level and performance level with ASCAP, BMI, CSAC. We're partnered with them. We have licenses for them, just like Tim does. We also do a fair amount of interactive radio streaming on our mobile application, and so we pay Sound Exchange for that. So there is a long, very complex list, and our lawyers probably know all the specific names, but it's a long, long list. And that's a challenge. It's a challenge because as a small startup in Silicon Valley, it's not having the wherewithal or the initiative to do it. It's the time required. It's the number of hours. It's also the ability to build a business while also trying to acquire these rights and keep everyone in the ecosystem happy and balanced while you're trying to build a business that's on a short lifetime. So I think I will emphatically agree with Tim that statutory compulsory licensing is going to be the biggest single, and have it be rational, by the way. It can't just be bad statutory rights. That's going to be the single biggest driver of innovation when it comes to music and online music and digital music. So I'm looking forward to that day.
So, Steve, you still allow iMe members to upload songs, right? Mm-hmm. So give us the example. The user uploads a song. Someone else wants to listen to it. How do you do that, in compliance with everything that you're dealing with?
Sure. So the seminal series of rights that took us so long to get done with the labels and the publishers and the indie labels and the indies distributors and everyone was the idea that users should be able to upload their MP3 library. They should be able to upload their MP3s, their favorite MP3s, to our web servers. We won't permit them to be re-downloaded for free, but what we'll let them do is to be able to have this as a streaming song, available to be added to a playlist, available to be played back. And what we do is we get the permission of the copyright owner of that song on both the master recording level as well as the publishing layer, and then in the attention or the online activity that generates from that, we'll serve advertising against that. That's display ads, graphic display ads, audio ads, video ads, premium sponsorships around that content. It's very similar to what you see in the portal model, the online media model. It's not that dissimilar from that. You're monetizing time spent online. You're monetizing at a better rate when it's more frequent. When the premium entertainment content is better and more popular, it builds scale and magnitude in your business to support an ad-supported business. So we just brought what was the DNA of the ad-supported content model in Yahoo, AOL, MySpace, et cetera, and we brought that over into a rich online music experience. So part of those rights are getting our users basically the blanket rights to upload their libraries. We provide a strong amount of security around not being able to download them and re-rip them. We let them create playlists on demand and create widgets and embed them outside of iMeme.com and other sites. And this is the fun part for users, is to be able to create a playlist or a video playlist and then other people to grab it and embed it in their MySpace profile, their Friendster profile, their blog, Pitchfork. You know, all these bloggers are using iMeme widgets to be able to say, these are the hot songs that I'm listening to. These are my editorial staff picks, things like that. The power of that is the organic crowdsourced nature that Naim referred to. That's what we do. We're not a curatorial or editorial service. What is popular on iMeme is completely one-to-one reflected by what people like in the iMeme user community. Me personally, I have to sometimes divorce my personal tastes from what the mass loves. And as we get bigger and bigger, it reflects more and more of what you see out there. Well, what's important is that it's personalized to your taste. And so everyone, every iMeme user's experience is different from every other iMeme user's experience. There's no two similar experiences when you log into iMeme, because everything you do is registered as data, and it personalizes around what you're doing.
Great, thanks. Dana, as an independent artist who has a band and wants to get started, can they use CreateSpace to get started, and how would they go about doing that?
Absolutely. So our members simply log on. It's a free membership, and they can upload their audio, upload their artwork, set it up through their member account. They set their list price, and then anytime that a sale's made, they choose their sales channels, and anytime a sale's made, they earn royalties.
And they can upload their songs to iMeme.
Absolutely. And again, we're kind of the infrastructure to create the media when it's sold. And then there's, Amazon and other sales channels to sell it. But, our most successful users are out there promoting their work, using social networking, using creative co-marketing, doing all sorts of things to get the word out about their content. And then as far as the royalties go, I mean, again, we're dealing directly with the content owners, so we don't have as nearly as complicated licensing issues as you guys do. But as far as, what artists earn, a typical CD, for example, say it was sold at $15, the artist, if they were selling that through their e-store, would earn about $7.80 per sale. So it's about a 50% off of that. If they're selling that same thing through Amazon, they'd earn about 22% of the sales of the list price. And again, it's a list price based thing, so discounting doesn't take away money from the artist. So it gives them a lot of control over it. And then we also obviously support digital downloads. And that's a little different price model that's based on number of tracks and that sort of thing. So for an artist that had an album with 10 tracks on it, that was they choose the price tier. It'd be about $6.18 for an album sale through digital. So it's a pretty, again, a pretty rich deal for our members.
Great, thanks. One thing that's obviously been very exciting in the music space is mobile and what's happening there. So I'd like to sort of find out the initiatives that each of your companies is doing in mobile. And Nyan, can you speak to that on the Spin side?
No.
Okay.
I can speak to it, but there's not a great deal to say at present.
I'll jump in. So we love mobile. Pandora launched we've actually been on mobile for a couple of years on AT&T and Sprint on a bunch of feature phones. But about 6 months ago, we launched Pandora on the iPhone, which has really changed our world pretty dramatically. We have a little over 3 million people that have activated Pandora on the iPhone. We add about 20,000 a day. And beyond the acceleration that it's given our user growth, I think more importantly than anything, it's actually got people thinking differently about, internet radio, which I think most people would kind of consider a proxy for a computer radio. Now people are taking Pandora on the iPhone and plugging it into their car stereos or taking it to the gym or actually docking it on their home audio systems. About half listening on Pandora on the iPhone is over Wi-Fi, which is really people using it at home over their Wi-Fi networks. And that's – the iPhone has really triggered, an avalanche of activity in folks who make connected devices, which increasingly means every single piece of consumer electronics hardware, whether it's a picture frame or it's a Blu-ray DVD player. And for folks like us in the radio world, our goal is to be as ubiquitous and easy and available as broadcast radio is. So rather than operating on the sort of computer office part of radio, we now get to play everywhere. And I think, you know, we've seen in the last 4 or 5 months a pretty dramatic change in kind of our opportunity and also, more importantly, I think, in the minds of consumers that are seeing this as something that they can use in lieu of broadcast music radio, which for all its strengths, I think, comes short for a lot of people.
Thanks. And Steve?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think the mobile recent developments in mobile over the last year have been truly revolutionary. Not like, oh, incremental change and this is great. I've been hearing about the promise of mobile since '98, and I actually never. There were incremental changes that improved. I mean, we all saw it as we replaced our cell phones. It got better and better, but it wasn't like there wasn't any one big variable step change there. But in the last year, I think what happened is that developing to mobile became almost as easy as developing a website. So for those of you that are deeply from the technology world, you'll know that it's not that hard to create a website. You can put up, I mean, it's hard to make a quality website, but you can put up a website, right? You can put up your own personal site immediately, call a web host, get it up there. You don't even have to call a web host. You could just sign up on any online web host and get it done right away. You go to GoDaddy.com and you get your domain and everything. You're up and running. Now imagine, like, rewind and imagine if Comcast said, well, you have to get my permission to create a website and you're going to pay me half of everything you make off of your website. And, oh, by the way, Dell and Apple and all these device companies are like, you have to get my permission to put your website on as well, too. So that's pretty much what the mobile industry has been up till very recently. You had to get the device, in the U.S. at least, you had to get the device manufacturer's permission. You had to work with them, work with their proprietary APIs. And then you had to pay a 50% or greater tithe to the service provider, the operator. If that were the case in the web world wouldn't be what it is today. You'd have, like, a bunch of crappy sites, and then you'd have, like, maybe a few good sites, but they have no business model. So the iPhone platform, the Android platform, the upcoming BlackBerry platform, Symbian, I heard, is kind of like this too, but I haven't seen many of those in use in the U.S. yet. So now mobile for companies that were classically on the web, like Pandora and iMeme and a multitude of other companies, can develop really cool applications that actually work, that people don't hate. And that's really cool for companies like us because we don't have – we're
so
not –
why aren't you on the iPhone?
Yeah, well, we developed to Android, and it's been successful. We're the number one music app on Android, and we're excited because that's it's a third-party operating system. It's not tied to one device, and we saw, you know, for our first foray into mobile that would be a good bet. It's built on a Linux kernel. Multiple handset providers can, handset manufacturers can use that. We also like the iPhone. When we're going to develop to the iPhone platform as well. We're not religious about the device. We're not religious even about the platform. What we want to be able to do is build good products for our users. Our users start from the web on iMeme, and what we're trying to do, our position on this is a little bit different than a lot of mobile apps. We're trying to extend the time spent online on iMeme by moving into mobile. So seamlessly, they should be able to be on a web browser and then get up, walk with their phone to wherever they're going, and to be able to have a similar experience, as hopefully just as powerful and personalized, and have that on their phone as they're going. And the music industry has differing opinions about whether or not that's a good thing and whether or not they want to permission that. But I think we all know it's going there. It's important to users and people on a very personal level. They spend more time with their phone than they do with their PCs. And so I think for us, it's a huge opportunity. And it's also an amazing opportunity in terms of creating a totally new usage type. Tim referred to a lot of the great stuff they've been doing with devices and alternative mediums like the car, things like that. And I think this is absolutely necessary. Like I don't listen to the terrestrial radio in my car anymore. You're listening to the same 10 songs on the same stations. With Pandora or with iMeme or with any of the other strong digital music services, you could have a totally personalized experience anywhere you go, and that just hasn't been possible until this year.
And one of the things, too, that's great is
these are monetizing well, too. So that's part that, you know, one of the long poles in the tent for mobile products is if you can make money off them. And the same way these devices offer great UIs for the service, they also offer great UIs for advertising. And, you know, businesses happen where advertising succeeds. And we've seen great success. In fact, the mobile advertising is a shoehorn for us for web advertising. It's so attractive to marketers. One other thing, too, we found really surprising, 3/4 of the people who have activated Pandora on the iPhone are new to Pandora. So, you know, it tells you something about what the audience really is. That's strange to me because maybe I'm not a mobile kind of person. But most people come to things through mobile devices, apparently. And I think it's very, very kind of a window into what's really going on out there.
That's really interesting. Mm. Yeah, it's a different generation than mine, I think. But Dana, can you tell us about does CreateSpace have a mobile strategy?
Well, given that, again, that we're kind of focused on physical product, mobile isn't as directly applicable to our business model, but it certainly ties into our members helping connect to their audience. So some of what Tim's talking about here certainly helps expand the reach of our members to find fans, to connect with them, and get discovered. So it definitely is an important direction for us.
Now, on the music side, too, sorry to pipe in again, but one of the great things about mobile products is that they have location services. Now, you have to give permission to use them. You can't just arbitrarily do that because of law. But in the music space, that offers some incredibly exciting opportunities because you know where somebody is. You know, as you're listening to the music, if they indicate a preference for something, you can imagine some really wonderful services that will tell you, oh, you like that band. They're playing, you know, in Palo Alto. Is there live music in Palo Alto still? they're playing in Palo Alto on Thursday night, and here's a ticket for $5. And I think that the sort of underlying theme to all the things, what's that?
The edge, right?
The edge is still there. No, it's not. What is it? A cafe now, like a mocha cafe, sushi
That's
bar.
Right.
The theme for all of us, I think, what we're all trying to do is to scale access to audiences, and the web is this place where ostensibly an enormous amount of content can reach a large audience. And the historically, we've been in a curated world, right? Broadcast media that has a single playlist or a single publication and a small number of slots for the content. And now we have, you know, virtually infinite content. And then the challenge is how do you kind of, in a scalable way, connect all that stuff effectively to this very large audience? And, you know, in particular case of music, the lifeblood of musicians, I think, will increasingly become revenue from live performances. And so solving the problem of getting 100 people at your shows instead of 10, in my opinion, is kind of the mother lode in terms of building this musician's middle class. And the key to that, I think, is, you know, effective, targeted recommendations. I was in a band for a long time. You know, we drove our van thousands of miles and played for audiences mostly a lot smaller than this. And it's incredibly inefficient. And there was no means for you to let people know when you were coming into a new town. And it's exhausting to go back to Colorado 3 times in a year. And maybe you add 10 people each time. This kind of system, this kind of ecosystem has the potential to explode the exposure you have in very local markets. So, you know, it's there. There are technical hurdles, there are database hurdles, but all the building blocks are there now. I think the mobile piece is critical.
Yeah, it sounds like it. That's great. So, Nayan, coming from the offline world, from a paper publication to online, and obviously newspapers, magazines have been very challenged, and it seems like Spin has been one of the success stories in making this transition. So can you tell us a little bit about how you managed the transition, and do you think you're there, or is it something that you're still a work in progress?
Very much a work in progress. And I think that,
you know, technology is evolving quickly, and with it, as it does, it brings more opportunities for us. And in a sense, the fact that we have not been we don't have an old website. We have a fairly recent one, and I think it preserves flexibility for us in a way that's useful. We're looking now at a product that we're going to be introducing called Spin Earth, where we have actually journalists might be too strong a word, people with cameras, all around the world who are sending in feeds to us so that we'll be able to see, learn what the music scene is like in Zimbabwe and Berlin and Trenton, New Jersey, and, you know, wherever people may be that they're seeing bands. And it brings some of that live experience and the freshness and vitality and ability to discover new bands.
And you're really tapping into the mobile network.
We are, yeah. Yes. And people are using their phones, I have to say, you know, to video things and send those videos in. So in that sense, we are using, you know, mobile technology. And we'll continue to, and I'm sure that we'll discover more, you know, applications for it as we go along. I think we're at a time where we do have a foot in both boats, and I think that's a useful thing for now. I don't know whether it will be always, but so that too is moving.
Great. We're about to go to the audience questions. We've been accumulating quite a few, but before we do that, I thought I'd just go down the row here and see what people think is sort of the next cool thing in digital music that's on the horizon that might be new to our audience that we should keep an eye on. Nyan, do you want to start and come down?
I think you should start with the digital guys.
Okay. We'll start on this side.
I think the next cool thing in digital music is when musicians start to get their act together to take advantage of it. And I think that will happen as they start to realize the potential. And I think you will start to see bands adding members whose job is not to play an instrument, but their job is to get on all these websites and get their CD on demand stuff set up and get locally targeted concert information out there and develop their Facebook presence and MySpace presence, make sure they're on Pandora, you know, iMeme, all these social networks, and kind of like the sort of equivalent of a digital fifth Beatle. And think of that person as a member of the band, you know. They get to weigh in on the set list. They're on the album cover. And their role is no less important than the bass players. Maybe the bass players is more important, but good bass players are hard to find. But I think that musicians have a huge part to play here, and they've been asleep at the wheel. And musicians don't tend to have those skills, right? You tend to be an artist, and you don't want to think about those things. But if you don't do it, you do it at your peril, because your future depends on leveraging all those sort of assets. So that's my call out to musicians is, you know, get cranking on this stuff.
Great. Steve?
So I'll talk about a different information situation. So to date, we rely upon SoundScan, Nielsen, Arbitron, Billboard, stuff like that for our information. Outside of that, radio spins, plays, things of this nature. It is really interesting how there's so much activity and so much love for music and so many different things that are happening and how little data we've had. I helped run an indie label in San Francisco while I was at a startup as a developer, and I remember like our best barometer for how popular our music was, because we're an indie label, like no one cares about you when you're a small indie label, not the research providers. We'd go on Napster and see how many people downloaded our stuff, and we're like, we're pretty, that song's pretty popular, that one is not. And we take that, and we go talk to Revolver Distribution in Ventura Hill and go, look how many Napster downloads. And they're like, wow, that's great, and sign you up. So, and then we went to Caroline and showed them the same thing. It's like, they're the major labels looking at the Napster numbers going, that's great. That's really interesting. So what, and Pandora and us and Spin and everyone here, CreateSpace, Amazon, iTunes, we all have data. We all have massive amounts of data. But we're all, you know, it's proprietary data. We use it for our profit motive, and that's fine, because we can't continue to provide our services unless we can like keep sustaining a business, right? Just like everyone else. But when you get to the point where you can start using that data to do really interesting things, not just marketing and not just targeting and not just recommendation algorithms, which we all do, but being able to use that data to create new experiences as well. And so rather than just like the music industry, the artist community and the labels and the publishers and the digital services and the media and press around it, but to be able to have data that creates totally new experiences, like we just ran into a very cool thing that happened because of our mobile app. I'll give you an anecdote. We launched a Twitter app integration with our service. We launched a mobile app. What happens now is I'm streaming from my Android iMeme app, and it shows that not only am I streaming it, but I favorited this song, and it shows it into my iMeme, and all my iMeme friends see it in the newsfeed in iMeme, and then that gets auto-posted to Twitter. It gets auto-posted to Facebook status. It's hyperlinked. People are looking at it. So with one action on my mobile phone, I've hit 1,000 people on Facebook. I've hit 500 people on Twitter. I've hit 4,000 people on iMeme. And all I did was listen to a song and favorite it. So I chose to link all these services together. It was very easy. It was on or off. It wasn't like I coded it, right? It's very easy to do. So now all these disparate kingdoms of data are interconnected because I chose to. As a user, I self-selected and opted in to do that. The power of data is not just what I get back, like how many plays, like we can tell you how many times, like any of these services, any of our services can tell you how many times this song was streamed at this hour, by this age, by this gender, on this day. We know we can. We all can. But that's just input back or output back to you. But imagine you create totally new features and music experiences based upon using data in a different way. So I think mobile is an example of that, because now data ports and the ability to work on mobile is changed. I think Tim talked about cars. I think cars is a huge thing. I mean, I would really, and I'm sorry if you're from Clear Channel. My friend runs digital at Clear Channel, but I hate listening to Clear Channel on the radio because I know, I could go to Billboard and find what songs. I know what songs are playing on Cameo because it's on Billboard. It's the top 10. So personalization, all this stuff, this is really cool. I think it's opening up because now finally the big rich companies like Nokia, Samsung, and AT&T, they all see value in it. So Finally it's opening up for the rest of us. So I think that's really cool for everyone.
No, that's a great point. There are going to be a lot of new models coming out of that kind of data sharing, I'm sure. Dana.
Well, I know we're running short on time, so I'll try to keep this really short. I think the next big thing is artists actually being able to make a living off their work. I think that's really, for me, one of the super exciting things that's happening. You're seeing all the pieces of this come together. The people on this panel are really pointing that out. We have members that have been able to quit their day jobs and make a living off of selling their content through our service, and that is just incredibly exciting. To be one piece of that. There's a lot of pieces that need to line up, but I think we're at just an incredibly pivotal time where all the technology and the abilities to link these all together is really happening. So people making money off their music, that's kind of a new and exciting future.
Certainly. So, Nayan, do you have anything to add?
Well, I see it sort of in the same way, and I think that all the advantage of all these incredible ways of promoting bands and writing about them and introducing them and linking them together and telling your friends about them and so forth really should just lead to more live music, more chances for musicians to play and people to go out and hear them. And I think that, you know, we've always thought of Spin as more a going-out magazine than a staying-in magazine. And I like that idea. And I like all the, you know, the festivals and concerts that have come up and the resurgence of excitement about live music that I think is largely fueled by digital connectivity.
Thank you. So I know that we've got a lot of questions to get to, so I'll let Martine take over on that side.
Well, thanks, Riaz, and thanks, everybody, for such a great panel. I just want to, you know, that was a fantastic discussion. And now we have a number of questions from our audience. So let me begin by asking, there are a number of companies providing online music collaboration services. Do any of you have licensing models to deal with the distribution of multi-user collaborative works?
We don't. we will play anything that is legally licensed, that someone has the right to distribute. That's kind of the only role we play there.
Yeah. CreateSpace certainly has members that have multiple people collaborating to create works. Currently, one of them needs to sign up, and then they can kind of do it on the back end, but we certainly look forward to expanding that in the future and making that collaboration easier.
Do you mean, who asked the question? I don't understand the question.
Okay. Well, I think this is kind of based on the BoJam model. I don't know who the audience member is that asked the question, but I don't know if it's online music collaboration.
Is it talking about the actual literal action of collaboration, of producing music?
They're saying,
or is it talking about a remix or a mashup?
Who asked the question?
Okay.
Normally we don't
do this.
I'll
assume that it's talking about like the end product.
Yeah, it says distribution of multi-user collaborative
work. That's actually a really popular but unstructured gray area right now. You have a lot. It's basically like claim your music, and that's how publishers and labels and artists are sort of scouring the internet and trying to figure out what's what and stopping people from doing things they don't want. It's really Byzantine. It's very complex, but people love that stuff. Like, there are services like Hype Machine that really like are showing like these great mashups and remixes, and it's very popular. But a lot of artists don't like it, and that's their prerogative. It's their contents. It's their right to say no. And so there isn't really a good, clean, black or white way to deal with that. But one thing is for certain, it is popular with users as long as it's permission by the original content copyright owners. And so that's it's a human issue, not a technology issue.
And also, Steve, I think actually what they're talking about is when if there's multiple users, like on iMeme, they would all have to register with Snowcap to get paid for their works to be played.
No. Right? In Oasis in music licensing, actually that part is relatively stable in that a lot of labels will pay on behalf of the publisher. It will take care of the publishing, right? And one master recording owner will pay the multiple producers of a song. So in master recording right and publishing right, they actually have their stuff together on that. The problem is that once you start getting to alternative formats that technology enables, like remixes and things like that, live shows, right? How do you deal with a live show? Is that, you know, there's still a question, is that a master recording or just a publishing?
Nice. Right. Thank you. Okay, for Tim, this is a question for you. You spoke of the iPhone as unleashing enormous amounts of opportunity. Nokia is taking a different approach by bundling music with their Series 90 phones in Europe. What's your view of the comes with the music model, and will it be successful in the U.S.?
So our whole sort of theory of the case in music is, you know, historically in America, an average person listens to about 20 hours of music a week. And about 17 of that has been radio historically. So in spite of all the big CD collections and iPods and such that we own, only 3 of the 20 hours a week is of music that we actually purchased. In other words, kind of the on-demand part of our experience. And I'm guessing anybody who's has a CD changer or an iPod knows why. Like, you get tired of what you own, right? And so we fundamentally don't really believe that people will pay for extended on-demand use. We don't really believe in the subscription business. We think that that in the end, music is mostly a somewhat passive experience that you kind of go back to occasionally. But we've based our business on that belief. So I wish it wasn't so. I wish that people were eager to pay, you know, monthly fees or substantial premiums to get access to on-demand content. But I don't think that reflects the general usage behavior of music.
Hmm. Okay, but there is success with Rhapsody, huh? That's a subscription service.
It's a subscription service, but it's not growing much anymore. And I think there is an audience for it, but it's not the vast audience. It's a smaller audience.
Okay. All right, another question for you, Tim, having to do with the human genome. The music genome, excuse me.
Oh,
that was last night's panel. Did you copyright or otherwise protect your taxonomy or other aspects of your curation? How does it compare to crowdsourced collaborative filtering quality?
So, yeah, we do have some patent protection, although I'm not sure that's really what makes it defensible. It's the fact that it took 9 years and 50 musicians to build it that makes it defensible. You use patents, I think, more to protect yourself than anything. And then in terms of how it compares to collaborative filtering, I don't consider one or another methodology of sort of recommending or playlist creation to be better or worse. You know, iMeme has one based on sharing, and that's historically been a great way to do it. And I think people have different preferences. There are folks who don't like Pandora's playlists. The one thing, I think, advantage that the genome has, that approach over one that's purely based on collaborative filtering, is that it's the one method that's not a popularity contest. So if you're an unknown band, you come out with a brand new CD, there's no purchase history or preference history or anything behind you. So to a collaborative filtering engine, you might as well be, you know, a bottle of shampoo or something. Because you're defined by your history. On Pandora, if you're brand new, we know where to put you. And that's sort of like what we call in our company first insight. You know, how do you take all this stuff that nobody knows about and find it the right space for it? Once it gets there, I think then the audience can take over. And in fact, on Pandora, we have an immense amount of contextual feedback because people thumb songs up and down. So as the audience kind of takes over from where the genome starts, we start to incorporate that. So it plays a significant role now. We have 2.5 billion pieces of thumb feedback on Pandora.
Yeah. You know, I have a question about the thumbs because it's interesting how it must increase your CPMs. So this was a question in the pile anyway about market CPMs. How have the thumbs helped with CPM? Have you seen a response from advertisers that they like that? Obviously, it's showing that there's some stickiness there. They're paying attention. They're looking. They're thumbing. They're looking. So...
Yeah, that's true. In fact, when we first launched Pandora for free, we had no idea how we were going to pay for it because historically on online radio, people turn the radio on and minimize it while they do something else and don't go back till they turn it off. We actually thought of a version of Pandora that would look like a spreadsheet so you could have it up and look like you were working and we could show advertising for you. Maybe we'll build that someday. But it turns out that people like to interact with Pandora, so they actually go there to thumb and skip and create stations, and that is exactly what you said. It generates the inventory. And it's not only inventory where we know the person is looking because they've just done something on the site. And furthermore, the value that you're there for is auditory. You're there to listen to music, which doesn't compete with the visual advertising. And for a marketer, it's like reading the back of a cereal box while you're eating cereal. You know, it's got that virtue of being engaging but not competing with what you're there for. So we've kind of discovered in the last couple of years that there's a really nice advertising model underneath this that, you know, frankly, we didn't know when we started.
And so about market CPMs, can you or Steve comment on what we're seeing? I know that there's been some comments in the blogs lately about the fraction of a penny per play and that it's just digital pennies. And Steve and I were talking earlier about this, and you had an interesting explanation. You want to comment?
Yeah. Well.
Truck it. Hit something. Okay. Everybody's okay.
So I think the advertising, the online ad-supported content world, portals, and all the websites out there, that's actually a relatively new sector or business concept for most of the music industry. Most of the music industry's experience with online ad-supported world was buying ads, right? Not receiving money from ads. So in a weird way, somehow these two industry sectors have operated relatively apart and not really benefited from each other in a direct, legal, and, like, expansive way for the last 10 years. So there's a lot of, hey, so how do you – is it a unitary cost and unitary revenue? I'm not going to get too geeky on this, but basically is it one cost unit for one revenue unit, right? And so what is that? You're used to that in a downloads. There's a wholesale and there's a retail, and the difference is what you make, right? As a retail service, in the online ad supporter world, you're not monetizing the stream or the play so much as you're monetizing the time spent by the user on the service within which you are offering streams and plays. But guess what? They're also doing thumbs up, thumbs down. They're doing things like favoriting something, featuring something, adding it to a playlist, commenting to it, doing all these different things. And so all of those interactions amount to what we're in the online ad supporter world trying to monetize. Our system is a little bit more complex because it's a social network, so you have all these different clicks and page views and impressions happening. So when we think about a stream, we think about how many times can we monetize without making the user totally, like, freak out and leave, right? Retaining user experience so that it's not bad. And they're still having a good time around music and around sharing music with their friends. So when you think about royalties and all that kind of stuff, you have to think about how is the service, how is the company, able to monetize that and create a layer cake of revenue models. Just like if you think about, it's very analogous to an artist today. You're not there was a one size fits all buy a CD or buy a tape or buy a vinyl before, right? And concert revenues. And when that was one size fits all and everyone had a CD player, it was fine. And then all of a sudden the CD kind of crumbled. Now it's like, now you have to have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 revenue streams as an artist to make the same amount in aggregate. And so concert revenue, and now it's digital downloads, it's subscriptions, it's ad-supported, it's merch, it's all these different things. And so for us as a service, it's very, very similar. We have traffic. We get users, and they like our services. But we need to continually diversify our revenue streams. Otherwise, we can't support these services anymore.
When you say diversify your revenue streams, you mean move beyond CPM to package sponsorships?
No, we have CPC, CPA, CPM. We have premium subscriptions. We have a partnership with iTunes, Amazon, and ringtone providers and mobile companies to sell ringtones and ringbacks. I mean, we're in the same. This economy is in. We're all in the same economy here. There isn't sort of one panacea revenue stream that just floats everyone's boat. You have to diversify. You have to add on layers of revenue, and that's what we're all faced with. That's the challenge.
Okay. Well, I see I'm being cued for the last question. There are so many good ones. I'm sorry we didn't get to them all, but here's the last question. The panel seems to represent the A&R function of the 21st century. Artists and repertoire, right? That's true. What does this mean for the traditional label model? Will they die? Quickly or slowly? Open to the panel.
I want to hear the chief journalist in the house on that one first.
Well, I think there is still a place for them, but it's going to be primarily as marketing organizations for the artists rather than the traditional functions they've served.
Yeah, and, you know, I just would hate to sign off without mentioning what Spin did for Vampire Weekend. I don't know if, Nine, you have just 1 minute to comment, because it's such a special story here. There was a band that appeared at South by Southwest that then was featured on the cover of Spin magazine. And I don't know what it was, but within weeks it was on, they were on Saturday Night Live. They hit the top of the Billboard Top 20. Peter Gabriel covered one of their songs.
It was a young band from Brooklyn that was getting a lot of heat, and there was actually an editorial conversation about that. It was thought, we at Spin try to put bands on the cover that are very well known so they'll sell issues, and bands that are unknown because that's what we feel we do. We introduce bands that aren't known. And Vampire Weekend was one of those, and there was even a conversation about whether the tagline should be, why is this band on the cover of this magazine? But we dropped that and just put them on there. And even though some people asked that question to us in sort of nasty little notes, we feel that we helped launch them. And that was their first major exposure, and they went on to do very well after that.
All right. Well, that was fantastic. Thank you very much. Tim Westergren, founder and chief strategy officer at Pandora. Steve Jang, chief marketing officer at iMeam. Nye McAvoy, chief executive officer at Spin Magazine. Dana Lo Piccolo Giles, co-founder and managing director at CreateSpace. Riaz Caramelli, partner at Shepherd Mullin Richter & Hampton. And many thanks to our generous sponsor, the Shepherd Mullin Digital Media Law Forum, and all of you for joining us here tonight. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley is adjourned.